Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The wrath of winter. Millions remain without power in frigid temperatures as the U.S. continues to grapple with the effects of a major storm. Then, a crisis of care. The governor of New York admits underreporting the often deadly impact of the COVID-19 pandemic in the state's nursing homes. And searching for justice, the simple task of obtaining identification becomes a major roadblock to re-entering society for former prisoners.
You knew who I was when you sentenced me. So you kept me there 27 and a half years. You kept me there knowing who I was, right? And then you send me out there like you don't never know who I was.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Some of the worst winter weather on record is disrupting much of the nation's life again tonight. Extreme conditions have claimed at least 15 lives, stemming from a variety of causes, including a tornado. Stephanie Tsai has our report.
In southeastern North Carolina today, downed power lines and homes ripped off their foundations.
This is going to take a lot of hard work, effort between cleanup, rebuilding.
Officials say at least three people were killed and 10 others injured by a tornado that ripped through Brunswick County just after midnight. It struck with little warning near Ocean Ridge Plantation, a coastal community some 45 miles south of Wilmington.
We have a lot of hard work to do as a community to get it back to normal, to make the community safe for the residents to go back in to the areas that were unaffected. But it's definitely a very hazardous situation with debris. Homes damaged, stuff all over the place.
Elsewhere, more chaos from an unrelenting weather pattern that's gripped much of the country. Winter storm advisories by the National Weather Service again today stretched from coast to coast. Bitter cold in Gulf cities across New England and the eastern Great Lakes. Chicago woke up to more than a foot of snow, with more falling by the hour, and dangerous wind chills.
You really have to hold your ground. I mean, seriously, you have to be very, got to stand sturdy.
In the southern plains, record cold temperatures extended to another day. The surge in demand for energy has prompted more utilities across central and western states linked to the same power grid to initiate rolling blackouts. Today in Oklahoma, more than 130,000 homes and businesses were without power. In Texas, largely on its own electric grid, 4 million were in the dark.
It's cold. Kids around, trying to stay warm, fireplace, there's no firewood anywhere, no stores open.
Many rush to hotels to keep warm.
The temperature being so low, it gets so cold in my house so fast.
While others turn to shelters. But in Houston, Mayor Sylvester Turner said space is running out.
Because of COVID and the healthcare protocols, we simply can't take any more. We've gone significantly over and above what we had scheduled, what we had planned.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott deployed the National Guard to conduct welfare checks until power is restored. The weather brought COVID vaccine distribution to a halt in some places amid icy road conditions and widespread airport shutdowns. And it closed the Houston Ship Channel and Gulf Coast refineries, spiking the price of oil.
Just to underscore the scale of this deep freeze, the National Weather Service put out a list of 20 cities from the Gulf Coast up through the Great Plains that are seeing record low temperatures today. The demand is taxing the capacities of energy grids, most significantly in Texas. To help us understand what's happening, I'm joined by Michael Wara, director of the Climate and Energy Policy Program at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. Michael, thank you for joining us. You know, Texas is the largest energy producer in the entire United States. How is it that residents there are in a situation of multiple days of power outages?
Well, it's a combination of two factors. One is really unprecedented demand for electricity during the wintertime. The demand for power has exceeded the grid planners' worst case scenarios by a significant degree. Also, power plants are not performing as expected, especially natural gas-fired power plants in Texas right now.
You know, it's interesting because some have actually used the energy crisis in the last couple of days in Texas to point out that Texas's turn toward renewable energy, namely wind power, is more the issue. Why do you say natural gas is the problem?
Well, I think, let me just say, it's a complex set of factors, but what we know right now is that the wind power plants are mostly meeting their expected performance levels. But what is not happening in Texas is that many of the thermal power plants, the plants that boil water to make electricity, like natural gas-fired power plants, coal-fired power plants, and at least one nuclear unit, are not producing energy. They're suffering outages. And that dwarfs the amount of wind resource that's not performing right now. So it really is a traditional power plant problem, not a clean energy problem.
Okay, but this is Texas, and they're not used to in February having peak demand for heating, for electricity. Could this have been anticipated in any way? And what does this say about the need to perhaps update infrastructure?
Well, I think this raises really important questions about how grid planners think about extreme events in the context of climate change. We saw in California this summer unprecedented heat waves that led to outages. And now in Texas in the winter, we're seeing an unprecedented cold snap. And this kind of extreme weather is what scientists believe is most likely to occur during climate change. And so it suggests to me that planners need to be updating their forecasts to take account of the extremes that are likely to come our way.
And what can be done in the near term that's realistic to update the nation's power grids to deal with extreme weather events, which you point out climate change is expected to bring more of, not just in Texas, but in California on the East Coast as well?
Stephanie, I think you used exactly the right word there when you said what can be done about the power grids. The most important step that the United States could take would be to invest in building a truly national transmission system. That's something that President Biden has suggested might be a good idea as a stimulus program. There's no question that having a national architecture for our power system would help us to avoid circumstances like what is happening in Texas and in the Midwest as well right now. If we had wires stretching from coast to coast, the places that had problems could lean on the places where there isn't bad weather, like where you and I are today.
And are you confident that renewable energy sources like solar, like wind, that the technology exists to store those energies the same way that natural gas would be, so that those transmission lines could actually reliably and flexibly carry that energy to customers?
Well, there's no question that long-term storage, particularly in the winter, is a really difficult technological challenge that we really don't have all the answers for yet. But we could certainly produce a lot more of our electric power from clean resources than we do today and do it reliably and safely if we had a more robust transmission system. I think in the long run, we're going to have to solve some difficult technological problems, but that's in the long run. Today, we could put much more wind and solar on the grid and serve everyone's needs, but we are going to need to build a more robust mechanism for getting that power to where it's needed.
Well, there are a lot of people in freezing cold temperatures right now in Texas and elsewhere in the country that are hoping for some solutions. Michael Wara with the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
In the day's other news, officials in some cities scramble to use up COVID-19 vaccine doses after refrigeration units lost power in the storm. At the same time, the federal disaster agency, FEMA, opened mass vaccination sites in Los Angeles and Oakland, California. Meanwhile, the president's top medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said that it could be late May or early June before vaccine is available everywhere, due to limited supplies. President Biden is on his first official trip outside Washington tonight since taking office, and he's pushing his pandemic relief bill. He headed out this afternoon for a Milwaukee and a CNN town hall event with an invitation-only audience. He said Republicans will hurt the nation if they unite against his $1.9 trillion relief plan. In Iraq, the U.S. began investigating an overnight attack that killed a coalition contractor and injured a U.S. service member and Iraqi civilians. Rockets struck at a military base outside Erbil. The U.S. State Department condemned the attack, but did not go further.
It would be premature to speak in specific terms about retaliation before we know precisely what happened. We reserve the right to respond at a time and place of our choosing consistent with our partnership with the people and the government of Iraq.
A little-known Shiite militant group claimed responsibility. The government of Iran denied any role in the attack. Police in Myanmar filed a new charge against deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi today. It accused her of violating COVID-19 restrictions, and it could keep her detained indefinitely without trial. Meanwhile, protesters again turned out in Yangon, chanting slogans against the military coup while lying down to block rail tracks. Others occupied streets near the central bank. Back in this country, a top Democrat in the U.S. House of Representatives sued former President Trump for allegedly inciting the Capitol insurrection. Mississippi Congressman Benny Thompson chairs the Homeland Security Committee. His lawsuit seeks unspecified damages. It could be the first in a wave of new legal action against Mr. Trump. The former president attacked Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell today as a, quote, political hack. In a statement, he blamed McConnell for losing the Senate majority and said if Republicans stay with him, they will not win again. McConnell voted to acquit Mr. Trump in his Senate impeachment trial, but he condemned his behavior. A cold and quiet Mardi Gras passed today in New Orleans. The pandemic and the weather canceled parades and kept Bourbon Street blocked off. Instead, homeowners had elaborately decorated their houses and front yards as stationary floats for people to visit. They range from life-size gardens to dinosaur exhibits. And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 64 points to close at 31,522. But the Nasdaq fell 48 points and the S&P 500 slipped too. Still to come on the NewsHour, the governor of New York admits underreporting the often deadly impact of COVID-19 in nursing homes. Yemen confronts a tenuous future amid war, the pandemic, and changing U.S. policy. Despite impeachment, acquittal, former President Trump still faces legal challenges in multiple areas, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
From the earliest days of the pandemic, when New York was an epicenter of COVID, Governor Andrew Cuomo often has been in the spotlight. That is partially because of the very public manner in which he first addressed the crisis. But increasingly, there are questions about whether his administration was transparent enough about disclosing how many nursing home residents died. As Amna Nawaz tells us, the governor is now at the center of significant criticism.
Judy, the governor admitted yesterday that he made mistakes when it came to not disclosing key data. Nationwide, by some estimates, more than 160,000 residents of long-term care facilities have died from COVID-related issues. That's about a third of all COVID deaths. About 15,000 of those were in New York State. But just a few weeks ago, Cuomo's administration reported only about 8,500 of them, meaning thousands of nursing home residents who died in hospitals were not included in that nursing home tally. Jesse McKinley is the Albany bureau chief for the New York Times. He's been covering this story and the fallout, and he joins me now. Jesse, welcome to the NewsHour, and thanks for making the time. Let's just start with why we're learning about this right now. What led to these revelations?
This actually dates back to a report from the state attorney general, Letitia James, about 3 weeks ago, which showed that the Cuomo administration had been undercounting deaths at nursing homes by about 50%. After the state was kind of shamed by this report, they began to release thousands of more deaths, which raised the death toll here in New York from about 8,500 to over 15,000, which is where we're sitting right now. Now, the Cuomo administration has said, of course, that the reason that they were slow to put out this data was that they were worried about an investigation from the Trump DOJ, which they felt was politically motivated. But lawmakers here in Albany have been a little bit skeptical of that, in part because the Cuomo administration had responded to that request back in September, but then didn't actually give up data here until February. So there's been a lot of skepticism about that explanation.
Of course, Governor Cuomo has been facing a lot of questions since that revelation. He addressed some of this in a press conference yesterday for the first time. Here is just part of what he said.
I am in charge. I take responsibility. We should have provided more information faster. We were too focused on doing the job and addressing the crisis of the moment, and we did not do a good enough job in providing information. I take total responsibility for that.
Jesse, the governor there, of course, taking responsibility, notably stopping short of apologizing even when he was explicitly asked to. Just among New Yorkers, how is that response going over?
Well, I think amongst common New Yorkers, it would be tough to say, but I will tell you here in Albany, amongst lawmakers, the response has not been a slam dunk. I don't think the governor probably went far enough for many lawmakers' taste, considering that he had basically stonewalled them for months and months and months on this data. Similarly, Republicans here in New York, who are a minority, of course, are outraged by this, have been calling for investigations, have been calling for resignations, and even on the Democratic side, there are similar calls. I mean, a lot of people at the kind of elected official level are quite upset about this, and I don't think the governor went far enough yesterday to kind of quell that sort of anger.
What about reaction from people who lost family members in nursing homes or long-term care facilities? Any reaction from them so far?
Well, I think particularly that's really where the rubber meets the road, because keep in mind, this wasn't just data for data's sake. You know, people were making decisions for their loved ones depending on whether or not they felt that nursing homes were safe, that you know, the death rates, if they were being suppressed artificially by the data not being up to date or not being complete, could have affected someone's decision whether or not to put their mother or father or grandparents into a nursing home. And so those sorts of reactions from people who either advocate for the elderly or have elderly parents, there has been a lot of upset about the way the governor has handled this since the very beginning.
Jesse, there was this early policy that Cuomo faced a lot of criticism for, which was to send nursing home residents who'd been hospitalized with COVID-19 back into nursing homes. There's now accusations that he was maybe intentionally misrepresenting the data or suppressing those numbers to deflect attention from that policy. Is there any evidence of that?
Well, since the very beginning, that policy, which was instituted in a March 25th memo from the State Department of Health, has been controversial. The governor's pushed back on it and said, look, we were just following federal guidelines. Other states did this. Now, the problem is that because the data has now been shown to be withheld, to have been incomplete, a lot of people took that as an admission of guilt. And the governor suggested as much yesterday that he had failed, that his major failing was in not batting back those sorts of reports, in creating a void, is the way he presented it, which then allowed these other theories to be represented. Now, keep in mind, more data has come out. Our publication and other publications will be looking very carefully at whether or not there was a spike as a result of that March 25th memo. And I think those reports will continue as the weeks to come.
It's worth reminding people early in the pandemic, New York was the nation's epicenter. When it came to the pandemic, we saw again and again hospitals overwhelmed, healthcare workers overwhelmed. And Governor Cuomo was held up as sort of a pandemic hero. He held those daily briefings that got a lot of attention. He was hailed for his response back then. He wrote a book about it. What did these revelations now, what kind of impact do they have on all that?
Well, I'll tell you, as someone who was at most of those briefings early on, you know, he was getting enormously great reviews from a lot of people saying that he was handling the situation in a way that the federal administration was not, that he was being forthright, that he was being honest, that he was following the data, that he was following the science, when the Trump administration sometimes wasn't doing that. Now, however, with these revelations, that sort of, you know, no-nonsense, straight-shooter kind of political brand that he had built up through this the early stages of the pandemic, that's really taken a hit, you know, because at its core, what we have been looking at is a government, a state government, that was not willing to be straight with the people who elected it, or the people that cover it, like myself, or the or its lawmakers, by telling them the truth about, you know, how many people died in these homes.
Jesse McKinley, Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Times, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about another podcast, Evil by Design, from CBC Podcasts. Women from around the world have accused fast fashion mogul Peter Nygaard of sexual assault and human trafficking for decades, earning him the moniker Canada's Jeffrey Epstein. He denies it all, claiming his accusers are lying as part of a vast conspiracy. Evil by Design, from our promotional partners at CBC Podcasts, asks, who are the women and men who have come forward, and which systems failed them? You can listen to Evil by Design wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Biden administration officially lifted the designation of the Iranian-backed Houthis in Yemen as a global terrorist organization. That announcement comes within a larger review of the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, which has waged a six-year campaign against the Houthis. It is one of the most significant foreign policy shifts yet of the Biden administration. Nick Schifrin reports on the prospects for diplomacy and speaks to the new U.S. envoy to Yemen.
When Yemen's new government cabinet arrived to fanfare 6 weeks ago, it was supposed to be a step toward ending the war. Instead, a Houthi rocket hit the tarmac. There was chaos and smoke. Parts of the airport were pulverized. For 6 years, the Saudi-led campaign tried to unseat the Iranian-backed Houthis from the capital, Sana'a. It failed. The Houthis are currently attacking the internationally recognized government's final northern stronghold. And last month, the Houthis hit another airport in Saudi Arabia and ripped a hole in a civilian airplane. But the campaign and Houthi intransigence have succeeded in transforming the Arab world's poorest country into a humanitarian catastrophe. The UN warns Yemen is in imminent danger of the worst famine in decades. And this year, 2 million children under five will suffer from acute malnutrition. Last month, the Trump administration labeled the Houthis a global terrorist organization to try and cut off their funding and weapons, in part supplied by Iran, over the objection of humanitarians, including World Food Program Director David Beasley.
It literally is going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions. It needs to be reevaluated, and quite frankly, it needs to be reversed.
Today, the Biden administration officially made that reversal. Tim Lenderking is the new envoy to Yemen.
Ending this war through a lasting political solution is the only means to durably end the humanitarian crisis.
Lenderking is leading a new push for diplomacy. Last week, he visited Saudi capital Riyadh with UN Special Envoy Martin Griffiths, and Griffiths visited Tehran. But diplomacy has been tried before. A 2018 deal largely fell apart. And today, Yemen is even more splintered, and both sides have more than enough weapons and incentive to keep fighting. The Biden administration is trying to put pressure on Saudi Arabia. It froze the sale of arms that the kingdom uses in Yemen, and it ended the targeting assistance that the U.S. military argued improved Saudi precision. During the campaign, President Biden warned Saudi Arabia that as president, he would hold them accountable.
We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are.
But today, the administration pledged to help protect Saudi Arabia from Houthi attacks.
We're not going to allow Saudi Arabia to be target practice. So Saudi Arabia needs to have the ability to defend itself.
And for more on this, we are joined by Tim Lenderking, the new U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen. Tim Lenderking, welcome to the NewsHour. Secretary Blinken said today that Houthi attacks are not the actions of a group that claims to want peace. How can you negotiate a settlement if one of the sides does not want peace?
I think certainly we see the Houthis in a pretty aggressive stance right now. If you look at just even the last couple of days, there are cross-border attacks on Saudi Arabia. And the offensive that they are apparently launching on Marib, which is a key Yemeni government town in northern Yemen and also has oil platforms, that's been fairly aggressive. Their movements on both of these fronts. I think we're going to have to test the proposition. They have sent messages indicating that they are prepared to do the heavy lifting for peace. Certainly what we're seeing in the last couple of days doesn't augur well.
Have the Houthis sent any messages to the United States privately? And does it matter if their public messaging are these ongoing attacks?
We have multiple ways of receiving messages from different organizations and multiple ways of sending messages to organizations. And in the Yemen context, we do want to keep the various channels open. They're going to be very important to us going forward.
Have the Houthis sent private messages?
As I say, they have ways of getting messages to us, and so we have taken those, and we will do our best to work constructively with those messages and with the various groups in Yemen who are supportive of a peace process.
Your critics say that lifting the global terrorist organization label on the Houthis before they had to make any concessions means you've lost a chance for leverage to try and get them back to the negotiating table. Do you believe that you've lost some leverage by lifting that global terrorist organization label?
I don't, in the end, think so. I think there was a decision, a realization by the new administration that the FTO designation was really a mixed bag, that on the one hand, it memorialized certain activities of the Houthis that were terrorist in nature, their attacks on civilian infrastructure, their kidnapping of U.S. citizens, their close relationship with the IRGC. But the new administration asked, well, what does that give us in terms of benefit to the political process and benefit to other aspects of Yemen? And there was a quick realization that it's a net negative on the humanitarian space, and that if we're going to make improvements in the humanitarian sphere, bearing in mind that Yemen is the world's greatest humanitarian disaster at this moment, we can't stress that system any further. So that is, I think, a key factor in why the administration decided to undo this designation. It doesn't remove every sanction on some of the Houthi leaders. Some of those remain from several years ago. So it's not a free pass at all.
As you know, in Sanaa, the capital, the Houthis have their own administration. They have their own police. They levy taxes. And of course, they continue to launch attacks both in Yemen and across the border in Saudi Arabia. You've put pressure on Saudi Arabia with some recent moves. What pressure on the Houthis is there to make any concessions?
I think that the Houthis need to be tested in terms of their stated commitments and the messages that they've sent, that they are committed to a peace process and to the betterment of Yemen. And I think there are international actors here that we're going to be leaning on and looking toward who have influence over the Houthis to see what they can do as well. This is not something the United States can do alone. It's going to require very close coordination with the UN envoy, Martin Griffiths, with the Saudis, and with the neighboring countries as well.
One of the regional countries, of course, that has the most influence over the Houthis is Iran. Last night in Iraq, a Shia militia took credit for an attack that injured five Americans, including one U.S. service member. And those were rockets that we have seen before from Iran. So do you believe that attack was by Iran? And what does it say to you about Iran's willingness to conduct diplomacy in the region?
You know, certainly when we look at Iran's behavior in the region, it's highly problematic and in many cases and antithetical to the peace efforts that much of the rest of the world is trying to engender. So whether you look at Iraq or Syria or other places where Iran uses proxy forces, and let it be known to the Iranians that if they want to do something positive for the region, Yemen is not a bad place for them to start. And that involves their relationship with the Houthis and the arming, the trading, the training and the abetting of the Houthis that they do. So it would be an excellent way for Iran to show goodwill by working in this diplomatic space that I've described to bring about the kind of better result in Yemen that we're all seeking.
during the campaign, as we saw in the story, President Biden referred to Saudi Arabia as a pariah and vowed to hold the kingdom accountable for the death of Jamal Khashoggi, who, of course, died in Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul. How will the Biden administration hold Saudi Arabia and Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, responsible for Jamal Khashoggi's death?
Well, my writ at this point really focuses on Yemen. And in the Yemen conflict, you need Saudi Arabia. And they'll have to play a leading role. After all, this is their backyard. This is the Gulf region's backyard. And just as we are, you know, follow things that happen in our backyard very carefully, so must the Saudis and so will the Saudis. So they will be a very strong partner in this effort, I'm convinced. And we'll be able to maintain the president's commitments with regard to Saudi Arabia while ensuring that that the Yemen conflict is brought to a close. That is very much the goal.
Tim Lenderking, Special Envoy for Yemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The new lawsuit we reported earlier against former President Trump over the Capitol riot adds to his legal challenges now that he's out of office. For the most part, they are state criminal and civil investigations, or lawsuits like the one today filed by private parties. But what conduct is still being looked at, and what, if any, consequences may result? Andrea Bernstein of public radio station WNYC has been reporting on Trump finances as part of their Trump Inc. project. And Andrea Bernstein, welcome back to the NewsHour. My first question, now that Donald Trump is out of office, is he in more legal trouble or less?
Well, he's certainly in a lot of legal trouble. I mean, we do know in the impeachment trial that the argument was he could be convicted because he was out of office, but that's the only case that I know of where it's better for him to have not been president. He has been arguing to great effect in the last several years that for various reasons under Article 2 in his argument, he couldn't be, in some cases, even investigated because of the presidency. He also used the power of his own Justice Department in many cases to file briefs along with his private business interests. And in one case, he argued that the Justice Department was able to defend him in a private defamation suit brought by a former gossip columnist. So now Trump, as a private citizen, has to defend himself as private citizens do. Now, while that may sound like justice may be more quickly delivered, when he was a private businessman, he was so notoriously litigious that cases went on, some cases, for over a decade. Mm-hmm.
And there now, I mean, we look today with you, and there are now so many legal actions surrounding the former president that it's hard to keep track of all of them. But you were telling us that it's the criminal investigations that may be most serious. Explain what those are about.
Well, President Trump, and before that, businessman Donald Trump, has been involved in thousands, literally thousands of lawsuits, but he has never been criminally charged. What he now faces in at least two jurisdictions that we know of are criminal charges. The most far along is the Manhattan District Attorney's investigation, which has not resulted in an indictment because Donald Trump has effectively gone to the Supreme Court twice to prevent the Manhattan DA from getting his tax returns. But if that case is resolved, as it's expected to be, the Manhattan District Attorney is looking at possibly indicting Donald Trump for bank fraud, insurance fraud, and tax fraud. Now, we don't know if he has enough evidence, if he wants to indict the president or his business or his associates, but the DA has said on the record that he is very seriously considering bringing charges. And the fact that this case has been going on for so long is further indication of the seriousness with which the district attorney is taking it. The second criminal investigation is much more recent, and this is in Fulton County, Georgia, where the district attorney there is looking at whether President Trump, then President Trump, violated racketeering and other statutes when he tried to overturn the election in Georgia. And that case, while much more recent, is in theory less complex than the white-collar crimes that the Manhattan District Attorney is looking at. So either of those cases could result in charges in some time in the not-too-distant future.
And then you mentioned, Andrea Bernstein, the number of civil lawsuits. And then there are the personal filing today, the NAACP on behalf of several members of Congress, including Benny Thompson. Tell us about the course that something like that could take.
Well, this is a very interesting case because it's using a statute that dates back to the 19th century, which was basically to use as a private weapon against the Ku Klux Klan by lawmakers who weren't allowed to carry out their official duties. And while a case like this can't result in jail time, what can happen is that through the discovery process and through depositions and possibly even a trial, we learn a whole lot of information that we don't know. And in these civil litigation cases, the private parties can use the power of the court system to bring forth information which can otherwise remain hidden. And we saw many, many questions left after the impeachment trial. So this would be an example of the kind of private litigation that could ferret out information that would not only potentially give the plaintiffs the relief they seek, but also give a lot more information for us as journalists and also for the history books about what actually happened leading up to the insurrection on January 6th.
Is it possible to say what the odds are that former President Trump could end up, through one of these verdicts, one of these decisions, in prison?
You know, it's so hard to say because there haven't even been any charges brought. But we do know, for example, in Manhattan, that the district attorney is looking at some conspiracy fraud charges, which are B felonies, carry up to 25 years of prison time in New York. So it's very, very serious. And because this investigation has been going on for 2 years, the suggestion is the district attorney really believes that he has evidence that crimes were committed. And when he gets all the documents he is seeking, that is when we might know what kind of charges the president or his business or his associates are facing.
Well, so many to keep track of, the defamation.
So many.
You know, from E. Jean Carroll, who had accused the president of rape, and then she says he defamed her. Then you have the hush money cases, but we don't have time to get to all of them. But we thank you, Andrea Bernstein, for keeping track of all of this. Thank you very much. Good to see you again.
Thank you. It's always great to talk to you.
For men and women coming out of prison every year, one of the first steps to re-entering society can be one of the most difficult, simply getting a valid ID. William Brangham examines the many hurdles returning citizens face trying to rebuild their identification. This story is part of our ongoing series, Searching for Justice.
After 27 years behind bars for armed robbery, in September, Kenneth Taylor became a free man. Free from jail, yes, but stuck in limbo.
I feel invisible. I do.
Why? Because Taylor left a Louisiana prison without any form of valid identification. No social security card, no birth certificate, no way to prove who he actually was.
It is, it's crazy. Nobody know I exist right now.
I remember this picture vividly.
He's been out for more than 4 months like this. His son, Ken Mackey, and lawyers at a local New Orleans nonprofit are still helping him piece his life back together, one document at a time.
It's been just obstacle after obstacle, trying to, you know, get his ID, his Social Security card, and birth certificate.
They've been in frequent contact with Louisiana's Department of Corrections, trying to get this fixed.
They attempted to send me a birth certificate and a Social Security card, which was totally not me.
They sent you identifications that they thought were supposed to be yours, and they were not yours?
They were not mine.
Taylor later received his actual birth certificate. That'll help, but he still doesn't have a Social Security card. That means he can't apply for many jobs or social services like food assistance. And in Louisiana, you can actually be arrested for not being able to provide proof of identity.
My biggest fear is being stopped by the police department and brought to jail because I don't have an ID.
Not having an ID is a problem that thousands of people face every year re-entering society. And during the pandemic, it's only gotten worse, according to Martin Horn. He used to be the head of corrections for both New York City and the state of Pennsylvania.
The offices are closed. Even the people who might be able to assist them in prison are often either absent because they're ill or working remotely. Not to mention the fact that prisoners, by and large, do not have easy access to the kinds of internet connections that would be necessary.
And without identification, Horn says it's impossible to reintegrate into society.
Getting out of prison or jail, the most crucial element to success is being able to support yourself. And without the documents, you can't support yourself. You can't get a job.
You have your passport, birth certificate, social, and two proofs of address.
Just navigating the bureaucracy can be overwhelming.
Two proofs of address. Mm-hmm. Well, I have one proof of address and my birth certificate and my social security card.
We're still missing one more proof because we don't have anything on file for you.
Marlon Jackson just got out of prison a few weeks ago. He served 24 years for robbery and sexual battery.
The only thing they gave me upon my release was this right here. That's it. They gave me no other form of ID, nothing.
He's at a mobile DMV office in Richmond, Virginia, trying to prove he's who he says he is and to get a legitimate legal ID.
We won't be able to take this because this is an original document.
The problem is the only document he received upon leaving prison had the wrong Social Security number on it.
This is not sufficient because I need a primary proof of address.
Sarah Scarborough is the founder of a nonprofit called Real Life. They organized this makeshift DMV because of the massive backlog created by the pandemic.
So if our folks got out of jail, they would have to wait for about 5 months to be able to get an appointment at DMV to get an ID, which means 5 months until they can get a job, 5 months until they can find a place to live and, you know, sign a rental agreement or anything.
After more than an hour of waiting and pleading, it looked like Jackson would be turned away. It seems he needed more evidence of his housing.
But you probably won't be able to get that today because we're only here till 11:30.
This moment right now is big. It's important. It's imperative. So if I don't receive an ID today, which I don't know, maybe I got 15 or 20 more minutes to get it, but, and hopefully I will.
But otherwise, you might have to be waiting 3 or 4 months.
Otherwise, I'd be waiting 90 to 120 days.
But at the last minute, with Scarborough and her colleagues' help, Jackson got his ID.
Go to the left a bit. There we go.
This is a start of something beautiful. It is a start, just a picture saying, hey, this is Marlon. This is where I live at. But it'll unlock one door.
This piece of paper is going to be crucial.
The last hurdle, though, for many formerly incarcerated people, is what's considered the gold standard ID, a driver's license.
Wow, I can't believe it. I could drive.
Anthony Gomez was released from prison in September after doing 23 years for a murder he committed when he was 17. He's just passed the Virginia driver's test after waiting weeks to get a DMV appointment.
You can get a DMV appointment to save your life.
Since his release, he's found a job as a paralegal, working with a lawyer he met while he was behind bars. He's now living with his mom outside of Richmond. He's hoping to also get some construction work, but he can't take a job that he can't get to.
You know, with those type of jobs, you have to move around. You know, you have to get from point A to point B, and then when that job is done, you have to get over here, and you can't be dependent on the people that's hiring you, you know, to come pick you up and then take you, you know.
Right. And I can tell from where you live, it's not like there's a bus or a subway at the corner.
Yeah. For that reason alone, like, I really want my license because I feel like, okay, it doesn't mean that I'm going to be getting in a car and disappearing every day. But I think just the thought that if I want to go somewhere, I don't have to be dependent on someone, you know, that's part of the freedom, you know.
Step two. Kenneth Taylor is still searching for that freedom. He found work as a personal trainer at a New Orleans boxing gym, but he remains frustrated that the Department of Corrections released him with no real way to start over.
You knew who I was when you sentenced me. So you kept me there 27 and a half years. You kept me there knowing who I was, right? And then you sent me out there like you don't never know who I was.
We reached out to Louisiana's Department of Corrections for comment on Taylor's case. A spokesman responded, saying, quote, Despite the pandemic, last year, 96.7% of inmates who were released from Louisiana state institutions walked out of prison with at least two forms of identification. Cases like Mr. Taylor's are the exception and not the rule. Generally speaking, do prisons and prison officials help people returning to society get those documents ahead of time?
Some more than others. I think there are very few that actually invest time, effort, and money in providing assistance in doing that. Because there is a cost to providing that assistance, but the cost of them being unemployed, the cost of them being homeless and in need of shelter, the cost of their admission to the emergency room, or the cost of a new crime and their re-imprisonment is going to be far greater than whatever we spend to facilitate their success.
Kenneth Taylor says he can't fully start a new life until he can prove his old one existed.
Oh, it's like a ball and chain, type deal. Like I'm still connected to the prison and I don't want to be connected to the prison system ever. I'm trying to chop the chain off, you know, where I can move where I want to move and freely and don't live in and be scared of anything.
That's for the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
In the aftermath of police killings of black men and women, and amidst renewed calls in Congress to consider a reparations commission, American institutions of all kinds have looked to their pasts and presents to understand their relationships to racism. That reckoning continues at colleges and universities, many of which have direct connections to the history of slavery. Jeffrey Brown has our report. It's part of our Race Matters series and our arts and culture coverage, Canvas.
On the campus of the University of Virginia, a new memorial to the thousands of enslaved people who helped build the school and then worked there. Craftsmen, construction workers, cooks, domestic servants. Some of their names are known. Most, more than 3,000, remain anonymous, honored by so-called memory marks in the stone.
And this site was picked intentionally because it was visible to and gestures to the community.
Historian Kurt Vondack helped lead the effort to uncover his school's past.
This story has to be visible on our landscape in a way that the casual visitor will understand when they visit here. And we have to acknowledge, right, the humanity, the skill, the life, the labor of the enslaved, and do it in a way that responds to current community concerns. And I think our memorial really does a fantastic job of that. But it's not an end, it's a beginning.
It's a story often hidden in plain sight, as in this 19th century engraving, intended to capture the campus in all its glory. There on a balcony, an enslaved woman holding the child of a professor. The campus was designed and founded in 1819 by Thomas Jefferson, drafter of the Declaration of Independence and slave owner, the embodiment of the contradictions of U.S. history.
The American Academy, writ large, not just UVA, has been built on money from the slave trade, built by enslaved people. It has a very long financial and human history tied up in this story that universities in some way are now coming to terms with.
It's not just in the South. Higher Education's Look Within began early in the 2000s at several schools, including Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island.
What can we do to suggest ways of being in the world that improve upon everybody's life?
Then President Ruth Simmons, the first African American to serve as president of an Ivy League school, and herself the great-granddaughter of slaves, says when she looked for the history, she found little.
And so what's the reason for that? I think slavery was an uncomfortable topic for people for so long in this country. And rather than deal with the issues involving slavery, people simply deleted the reference. And if you delete it long enough, of course, what happens is that there is this systematic forgetting of the history.
As documented in a landmark 2006 report, the history was all around, including lists of slaves trafficked in ships owned by John Brown, one of the school's founders. his former home across the street from the president's residence.
That's the thing, is that we were surrounded by the evidence of Brown's relationship to slavery at one time, and yet we chose to ignore it, and we basically built a new narrative around it.
With a more painful past revealed, Brown took a number of steps, including creating a new Center for the Study of Slavery and Justice, to further explore the history through scholarship and exhibitions. And it commissioned a public artwork titled Slave Memorial by prominent Black artist Martin Puryear.
To me, it always seemed the most important element of it was the truth-telling. So if one wants to atone for lying for so many decades, centuries even, the clear indication is that you should atone for that by telling the truth. And so the report to me was the most important thing. And it has lived long, actually. And I think it has been borne out by what followed, because that report has become the document that so many other institutions have used to follow that same course.
A consortium founded at the University of Virginia, University Studying Slavery, has grown to more than 70 members from 5 countries, in some cases moving beyond slavery times to study Jim Crow-era racism and injustices against Native Americans, their lands taken for use by Western colleges. Importantly, historically Black colleges and universities are also looking at their histories, and in some cases partnering with majority white schools on research and other projects. Ruth Simmons is now president of one prominent HBCU, Prairie View A&M University in Texas.
One of the things that we are committed to doing is making sure that these matters enter curricula and that people stop being afraid of the truth, afraid to teach what really transpired.
But after a year of protests in the wake of the police killings of George Floyd and other Black men and women, universities, like other institutions, face renewed calls to go beyond research and teaching.
This is the recurring question, what now? I think the what now is, there's no simple solution, but it's an awareness and a consciousness and a working through of the problem.
Leslie Harris, an historian now at Northwestern University, has studied both the past and contemporary efforts. The movement for direct monetary reparations has grown, but remains controversial. Harris and others propose another way in.
I want to remind people that the root of that word is repair. How do we repair? How do we make whole relationships and communities that have been driven apart? And that can come in many different ways.
Colleges are often the largest landowners and employers in their cities, with direct influence on housing costs and jobs. They employ their own police and security forces, in some cases exacerbating tensions with the surrounding community.
I could do the history all day of how we got here in terms of policing, how we got here in terms of real estate. The question, though, then becomes, and this is definitely a question for higher education institutions, it is not simply about studying and understanding and then putting the book on the shelf and say, phew, now I understand. It is about how do we move forward differently.
Study and remember what happened and seek repair. At a pivot point for American institutions of all kinds, scholars and activists are saying universities have a unique role to play. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
Continue to ask the questions, continue to seek the answers. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.